Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com. This is Anti-War News for Thursday, April 18th, 2024. Right, the first story at the top of antiwar.com today. Johnson unveils $95 billion foreign military bills. So on Wednesday, House Speaker Mike Johnson unveiled three foreign military aid bills for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, totaling over $95 billion in spending. And these three bills match roughly with the $95 billion foreign military aid bill that was passed by the Senate, although Israel gets a boost in military aid. Some of the economic aid for Ukraine is in the form of repayable loans. If you remember, Johnson was speaking about this recently. It's actually something him and Trump discussed recently, was this idea of giving loans to Ukraine instead of just giving them money that they don't have to pay back. So he included about $10 billion of the economic aid as loans, but there is a big asterisk there. According to the reports that I read, Ukraine's not actually expected to pay it back, and sources told CNN that the administration will have the power to cancel the debt. So really, it's just meaningless. So the bill for Ukraine, the bill to fund the proxy war in Ukraine, totals nearly $61 billion. So again, just right about what Biden was asking for. The Israel bill totals $26 billion, the majority of which will go toward military aid for Israel to support the slaughter of Palestinians, the slaughter and starvation of Palestinians in Gaza, and to replenish air defenses that Israel used when Iran launched that missile and drone attack. This $26 billion also includes $9 billion in humanitarian aid, which the bill says is for Gaza and Ukraine and other parts of the world. I think there's some money for Sudan in there. And Democrats said that this was necessary for them to support what Johnson was doing. So there's over $8 billion will go towards spending in the Asia Pacific to prepare for a future war with China. A few billion of that, it's not clear exactly how much, a few billion of that is going to go to military aid for Taiwan, which is very provocative. I mean, they're preparing for the next one with this. And this is something I've covered quite a bit, but I think it's really important to point out. The situation with Taiwan, the U.S. has consistently sold weapons to Taiwan since 1979, which was the year that the U.S. formally severed diplomatic relations with Taiwan as part of a normalization deal with China when the U.S. and China opened up. So they've sold weapons since then, but they never provided military aid. They never provided weapons free of charge or financed the deals until last year. So this is a new thing. And of course, China's not happy about it. So more of that. And Johnson is releasing a fourth bill for so-called national security purposes. The bill is expected to include a TikTok ban over unfounded allegations that the popular video sharing app is a Chinese spy tool. So they're going to do another. The House recently passed a similar bill, but they're doing it again. I guess they really want to ban TikTok. And this is just the type of overreach that we will see with this new Cold War with China. Is things like this that will affect Americans, you know, freedom to use certain things. And this bill is also expected to give the federal government the power to sell off frozen Russian assets to make more money available for Ukraine. And that would amount to outright theft. You know, that's stealing from Russia. That would be a pretty huge escalation in the economic war against Russia. And I read somewhere that the loan that they're giving Ukraine, they're hoping to pay that off with the Russian assets. But if not, they still have the power to cancel the debt. So it's a complete joke. It's exactly what Biden wanted. And Biden has come out in support of Johnson's effort, and he called for a quick vote. He said, quote, "The House must pass the package this week, and the Senate should quickly follow. I will sign this into law immediately to send a message to the world. We stand with our friends, and we won't let Iran or Russia succeed," end quote. And Johnson is pushing ahead with this despite the threats from Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie to hold a vote to oust him as speaker for doing this. Democrats have signaled that they will bail him out, that they won't vote against him. And the thing that they were saying he needed to do was basically include the humanitarian aid and basically make it the same bill. So if Biden's supporting it, I'm sure they're supporting it. I'm sure Johnson might get bailed out by the Democrats here. So, you know, this is just about as bad as it could be. And he said, he's saying that he's going to give them 72 hours to look it over. So that would put a vote on, that would mean the vote would be on Saturday. So it's possible that it could be earlier than that, but we'll see what happens, later this week. All right. So the next one here, the UK says that Israel is likely to respond to Iran. So British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said Wednesday that he believes Iran will respond, that Israel will respond to Iran's drone and missile attack, which was a reprisal for Israel bombing Iran's consulate in Damascus. Cameron made the comments while visiting Israel and advising against escalation. Cameron said, quote, "It's right to have made our views clear about what should happen next, but it's clear the Israelis are making a decision to act. We hope they do so in a way that does not that does as little to escalate this as possible," end quote. So Cameron made this comment, you know, while he's in Israel meeting with Israeli officials. He said this right after he met with the president, Herzog. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, she was also in Israel on Wednesday to warn against a major escalation. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu signaled that he would not heed the advice. Netanyahu said, quote, "I have just come from meeting with the British and German foreign ministers. I thank our friends for their support in defense of Israel. And I say this, support in both words and deeds. They also have all kinds of suggestions and advice, which I appreciate. However, I would also like to clarify, we will make our decisions ourselves. The state of Israel will do whatever is necessary to defend itself," end quote. And as we've seen from the reports on the Israeli war cabinet meetings, they have decided that they're going to respond in some way, but we don't know exactly what they're going to do yet. And it's also possible that they could be just bluffing, but we'll see. And then also on Wednesday, Iran reiterated its warning. President Ebrahim Raisi said that if Israel hits Iran, they're going to hit back much harder. He said, quote, "If we had carried out a heavier operation, nothing would be left of Israel, but it was supposed to be a limited action," end quote. And Iran gave the U.S. and Israel plenty of time to prepare for its attack. As Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that Tehran gave 72 hours notice to regional countries. The White House denied that Iran gave the U.S. a direct warning, but Turkish, Iraqi, and Jordanian officials said that they did receive a warning from Iran, and that definitely would have gotten back to the U.S. So I'm sure the U.S. had plenty of notice about this attack. And Iran also announced that it launched missiles and drones hours before they actually reached Israeli territory. So the U.S. is portraying the Iranian attack as a Israeli victory. And President Biden has said the U.S. would not support an Israeli offensive action against Iran. But at the same time, the U.S. is saying that they're going to continue to defend Israel. So if Israel goes out and launches an attack, some sort of big escalation, then the U.S. is saying that they'll be there to defend them. So, I mean, that kind of does mean that they are supporting an offensive attack if they're willing to deal with the consequences of it. So U.S. officials told NBC News that they believe Israel's response will be limited in scope and would likely target Iranian forces and allies outside of Iran. Israel has been targeting Iranians in Syria for years, but the consulate bombing marked a huge escalation since it targeted a diplomatic facility and killed a high-level Iranian general and six other members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. All right, So the next story here, 18 Israeli soldiers wounded in Hezbollah attack on army base. This article is from Jason Ditz. At least 18 Israeli soldiers were wounded, many of them seriously, when Hezbollah targeted an Israeli military reconnaissance command center in a drone and guided missile attack. Hezbollah took credit for the attack, which targeted a base in the northern village of Arab al-Aramsh. They said this was retaliation for an attack the day before, which killed three of Hezbollah's fighters, including two commanders. Israel's military so far confirmed 14 wounded, five of them seriously. They reported retaliating against the source of the missile fire. So this is, again, this daily, near daily tit for tat strikes across the border. And this seems like a pretty big Hezbollah attack. Yeah, 18 wounded, but nobody killed. But this is a situation, and a potential Israeli response to Iran could be really stepping things up in Lebanon. I guess that's a possibility. All right, the next one here. Leaked cables show that the U.S. opposes a Palestinian state. So this article is from The Intercept, and it says ahead of the United Nations Security Council action to consider the Palestinian Authority's application to become a full member of the UN, the United States is lobbying nations to reject such membership, hoping to avoid an overt veto by Washington. The lobbying effort, revealed in copies of unclassified State Department cables obtained by The Intercept, is at odds with the Biden administration's pledge to fully support a two-state solution. So this is something that the Palestinian Authority has been trying to become a full member of the UN. In 2012, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution granting Palestine the status of a non-member observer state. But this is the Security Council that would vote on them becoming a full member. And the diplomatic cables, and in the Security Council, the U.S. has veto power. The diplomatic cables detail pressure being applied to members of the Security Council, including Malta, the rotating president of the council this month. Ecuador, in particular, is being asked to lobby Malta and other nations, including France, to oppose UN recognition. The State Department's justification is that normalizing relations between Israel and Arab states is the fastest and most effective way to achieve an enduring and productive statehood. So they don't want the optics of the U.S. vetoing this request from the Palestinians. So this cable that they obtained details U.S. talking points against the U.N. vote for a Palestinian statehood. The cable says that Security Council members must be persuaded to reject any proposal for Palestinian statehood and thereby its recognition as a sovereign state before the council's open debate on the Middle East, which is scheduled for April 18th. So the U.S. continues to go to bat for Israel at the U.N. All right, so the next one here, after surviving airstrike, Palestinian boy killed by an aid drop. This article is from The Guardian, and this is a really sad story. So when an Israeli airstrike destroyed his family's home in November, Zain Orak was pinned under rubble. He was wounded but survived, while 17 members of his extended family died. But Zain, who's 13 years old, would later suffer a cruel fate in Gaza, where more than 2 million people have endured more than 6 months of food shortages and malnutrition. U.S. officials have said that famine is already beginning to take hold in parts of Gaza, where Israel and the Palestinian Islamic group Hamas have been fighting for more than 6 months. Last week, during an airdrop of aid, Zain was struck by one of the packages as he rushed to try to get a can of fava beans, some rice, or flour. So this boy, 13-year-old, survives an airstrike. He was pulled out of the rubble, an airstrike that killed 17 members of his family, and he was running to try to retrieve some of this aid that's being dropped from the sky because people are starving to death in Gaza because of the Israeli siege. And on the way, he gets hit by one of the things falling out of the sky and killed, and apparently people that were running towards the aid ran him over as well. So they quote his grandfather here, who said, quote, "The first time when the House was hit by a strike, he came out from under the rubble with wounds in his head, hand, and leg. God saved him," end quote. So the grandfather was standing by a large pool of wastewater. He recalled how Zion would swim into a pond of wastewater to get meals from the airdrops, and how he should have been at school instead. So it's just really a sad and horrific story, and just one anecdote from one boy, and just the fact that they're dropping this aid instead of getting Israel to end this thing and actually let a real humanitarian relief effort happen. All right, so the next one here. UN report says that Palestinians face severe abuses in Israeli detention. This article is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. It says the UN aid agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, released a report showing that Gazans rounded up by the Israeli military have been subjected to severe abuses. UNRWA found that some of its employees were subject to coercion and forced to make false statements about the organization's alleged ties to Hamas. Tel Aviv used those confessions to persuade Washington and over a dozen other nations to cut funding for UNRWA. So this was published on Tuesday. It's a new report. If these allegations sound familiar, it's because they have been made before, but this is a new report that details how Israeli soldiers have rounded up thousands of people throughout the months-long conflict. And those Palestinians have been moved into various detention centers across Israel and face inhumane conditions and brutal treatment by the military. UNRWA said, quote, "Ill treatment, including being subjected to beatings while made to lie on a thin mattress on top of rubble for hours without food, water, access to a toilet, with their legs and hands bound with plastic ties. Several detainees reported being forced into cages and attacked by dogs. Some released detainees, including a child, had dog bite wounds on their bodies. Detainees were threatened with prolonged detention, injury, or the killing of family members if they did not provide the requested information," end quote. So pretty horrific conditions. All right, so the next story here, this is an interesting one. The U.S. is endangering troops by refusing to leave Niger. So a senior Air Force leader, a whistleblower, said in a letter to Congress that the Biden administration's refusal to withdraw from Niger, despite an order from the post-coup government to leave, has put U.S. troops in the country and in the region in danger. So this whistleblower said that senior officials at the U.S. Embassy in Niger have intentionally suppressed intelligence to maintain the facade of a great country-to-country relationship as the U.S. is trying to figure out a way to maintain its military presence in Niger. The Nigerian government, known as the National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland, said in March that it was severing military relations with the U.S. and that the U.S. presence was no longer legally justified. U.S. officials have claimed that they did not receive an order to exit the country. So this whistleblower said, quote, "It is clear that the country of Niger does not want a permanent military presence in the country, and they have informed us that we need to leave. At the same time, there are approximately 1,100 U.S. military service members in the country who are essentially being held hostage from returning home to their families, while the State Department continues with failed diplomacy by not communicating with the country of Niger on what their withdrawal plans will look like," end quote. And this letter was obtained by the Washington Post. So if you remember, there was a story I covered recently where Niger held talks with the U.S., and the Nigerian officials came out and said that the U.S. will soon submit a plan to disengage troops from Niger. Then when U.S. officials were asked about it, they refused to comment on the talks, and they did not confirm what Niger said. So something seemed a little funny there. And what he's saying is that they're not communicating with Niger on their withdrawal plan. So there, it seems like they're just trying to stall in kind of a desperate effort to stay in Niger. So since the July coup that ousted President Mohamed Bazoum, U.S. troops in Niger have been on orders to sit and hold. The whistleblower said that U.S. personnel have had their deployments extended because Niger is not approving new visas for troop rotations. The airman said that all U.S. forces were scheduled to end a six-month deployment early this month when relief forces arrived, but they never got there. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, there was a congressional hearing on this on Tuesday, and Gaetz said that he spoke with U.S. Army soldiers in Niger and described similar accounts. He said, quote, "There are Army soldiers right now in Niger who are not getting their troop rotations, who aren't getting their medicine, who aren't getting their supplies, who aren't getting their mail," end quote. The whistleblower said that the U.S. actions in Niger, quote, "have potential implications for our bilateral relations with other partner nations and the safety of our personnel in the region," end quote. So a pretty crazy situation, it sounds like, since the coup, the U.S. troops in the country have been on what they call a sit-and-hold order. They haven't been going out and doing any operations. They're just stuck at these bases, and they can't go home, even though the country they're in doesn't want them there. And this whistleblower was based at Air Base 101, which is in Niamey, the capital of Niger, or it's probably outside the city. But most U.S. personnel are stationed at Air Base 201, which is the big drone base that cost over $100 million to build. That's the big thing the U.S. doesn't want to give up. So that's what this is all about. And the fact that they're just kind of playing this game and lying and saying, oh, we haven't been told to leave, and probably doing what they can. I mean, you know, it definitely puts the Americans who are there at risk. Being in a country, you know, there's only 1,000 of them or so, and they're in a country that doesn't want them there. All right, so the next one here, the U.S. is funding torture camps in eastern Syria. So Amnesty International said in a new report on Wednesday that U.S.-backed Kurdish authorities in northeast Syria are responsible for torture and mass death due to inhumane conditions at detention facilities that were set up after the defeat of ISIS. Amnesty said that the U.S. is involved in most aspects of the detention system, which holds more than 56,000 people, including 30,000 children, 14,500 women, and 11,500 men. The Kurdish authorities, officially known as the Autonomous Authorities of the North and East Syria region, and that includes the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, which is the U.S.'s main military partner in Syria. The majority of those in custody were detained in 2019 when ISIS lost the last significant piece of territory that it had. And these prisons, you know, these are most, you know, they rounded up ISIS members and their families. So you have children of ISIS members, also children who were recruited to be child soldiers, people just in this horrific situation. And Amnesty said that many of the women are victims of human trafficking and forced marriage to ISIS members, and many of the detained boys and young men are victims of ISIS's child recruitment. The report said that other ISIS victims are being held in the facilities, including as many as hundreds of Yazidis, people who were not involved with ISIS at all. And Amnesty interviewed people who were held in the camps who detailed the torture they experienced, which included beatings, stress positions, and electric shocks. One woman said, quote, "I was given electric shocks. I was pregnant at the time. The interrogator knew. He told me, I'm going to force you to have a miscarriage, and that's what he did," end quote. And so these are allegations, again, about a U.S., the main U.S. ally in Syria that the U.S. funds and everything. And the Amnesty report detailed how the U.S. has funded and supported these facilities. The report said, quote, "The U.S.-led coalition with funding from the U.S. Congress has refurbished existing detention facilities, constructed new ones, and frequently visits them. The Department of Defense has provided hundreds of millions of dollars to the SDF and affiliated security forces," end quote. Former detainees said that the combination of physical abuse, inhumane conditions, and the lack of medical care caused outbreaks of disease and other health conditions and led to the deaths of hundreds of people. So back in January 2022, this is something that a lot of people went under the radar, but this was January 2022. There was a prison break at one of these facilities in Hasaka, Syria, and a major battle ensued, and the U.S. gave air support to the SDF fighters on the ground. According to U.S. Central Command, more than 420 suspected ISIS members and 120 SDF fighters were killed in this battle. And there was witnesses and people who were there that said children were killed by the U.S. air support. There was a 17-year-old Australian boy who was in the prison at the time of the battle. He told Human Rights Watch that he estimated 15 to 20 children were killed, and he said that he was injured by a U.S. Apache helicopter strike. So just a mess of a situation. Kind of the U.S. Involvement in Syria is such a mess to begin with, but this is something, you know, it's been known for a while that the conditions in these prisons and camps are horrific. And this is just really detailing it. And by backing the SDF, the U.S. is able to control an area of Syria that's about one third of the country's territory, where most of the oil fields are. That's the U.S. military occupation. It includes the sanctions regime against the government controlled areas. Very brutal sanctions. And then this is what they're supporting in the territory that they control. All right. So the next one here, no sign of U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. So another one about the U.S. not leaving a country. So following a meeting between President Biden and Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, there's no sign that a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq will happen anytime soon, despite earlier calls from al-Sudani's government for an end to the presence. So Biden and al-Sudani met in Washington on Monday and released a statement reaffirming the U.S.-Iraqi military partnership. The statement said they would continue talks on the future of the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq, but the next meeting is not until July. The U.S. has about 2,500 troops in Iraq as part of an anti-ISIS coalition that formed in 2014. Al-Sudani has previously said that Iraq can handle the ISIS remnants that are in the country without the foreign coalition, but the U.S. is insisting on a long, drawn-out process to evaluate the threat of ISIS. And both sides appear to be leaving open the possibility of a continued U.S. presence in Iraq, even if the anti-ISIS coalition ends its mission in the form of a bilateral partnership. Biden and al-Sudani said in a statement together, quote, "The two leaders affirmed they would review these factors to determine when and how the mission of the global coalition in Iraq would end and transition in an orderly manner to enduring bilateral security partnerships," end quote. So they're saying they're going to transition to an enduring bilateral security partnership, which sounds like the U.S. troops might stay. So ahead of his visit to Washington, al-Sudani wrote an article in Foreign Affairs where he called for a new kind of partnership with the U.S. He said in that article that there has been an agreement to end the international coalition in a gradual and orderly manner. I don't think there has been an agreement, really. Doesn't seem like the U.S. has agreed to that yet, but he's saying that this committee that's going to hold these talks will develop a roadmap for future relations, including the presence of U.S. advisors. So again, leaving open this possibility. And al-Sudani began calling for an end to the U.S. presence a few months ago when the U.S. was bombing the Shia militias in retaliation for the rocket attacks on U.S. bases, which that started because of U.S. support of Israel and Gaza. So the whole situation was a mess. Al-Sudani said, you got to leave. And the U.S. said, no, let's talk, you know, let's start this whole long drawn out process. Tensions have eased in Iraq as al-Sudani's government and Iran both convinced the Shia militias to stop attacking the U.S. after those three American troops were killed at Tower 22 in Jordan. And of course, the Iraq's parliament voted back in 2020 to kick the U.S. out after they killed Soleimani, but the U.S. refuses to leave. They're basically holding the country hostage. And the reason that they could do that is because they control Iraq's foreign reserves. They have huge economic leverage over Iraq. They can completely destroy the Iraqi economy if they want to. All right, so the last story here, the New Hampshire GOP adds Defend the Guard to its platform. So this is an article from Michael Granger that we reprinted from the Libertarian Institute, and it's about how the New Hampshire Republican Party has added the Defend the Guard Act to its platform. And if you remember, Defend the Guard is the bill, it's a state-level legislation that would restrict the deployment of the state's National Guard to a combat zone. And this has been gaining momentum. It has passed several state legislatures now at this point. I think Arizona, Idaho, and New Hampshire. It hasn't become law in any state yet, but New Hampshire is one place where it passed the House, and the Senate is the next step. And so if you want to help out, I've been putting the link to the phone banking, to volunteer for phone banking with Defend the Guard in the description. So go check that out, or go to defendtheguard.us and you can look at a map and see what the status of this legislation is in each state. It's something that I think is really important, and something that really has teeth to it to restrict the federal government's ability to wage war. All these places I'm talking about, they send the National Guard, Niger, Syria, Iraq. That's who they're sending. Somalia, you know, they send other troops as well, but the National Guard is deployed there pretty regularly now. All right, so that is it for the news for today. Go check out our viewpoints. One from Jonathan Cook: the West now wants restraint after months of fueling a genocide in Gaza. One from Ted Snyder: this past weekend, Iran changed everything. One from Stephen M. Walt: America fueled the fire in the Middle East. One from Dan Steinbach: trilateral militarization, from missiles to nukes. And one from Tarnim Hamad: I'm shattered. My only comfort is my cat. And that is the account of a Palestinian woman in Gaza and living through the nightmarish situation there. So please go check all of that out. You could always support this show by sharing it. Tell your friends about antiwar.com. Like, subscribe, comment. All that stuff really helps. Follow us on Instagram, on X. I will be back tomorrow. One more show this week. So I will be back tomorrow. I'll talk to you then. Thanks for listening.